Stem cell research, physician-assisted death, organ transplants, the right to health care. These subjects elicit strong opinions, but often little consensus. Each and every day, bioethics, the ethics of medicine, public health, and life sciences research, directly affects all of our lives. In their new book, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die, Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno, two of the field's foremost leaders, illuminate a debate that has become even more consequential and contentious over the last 70 years. These decades saw remarkable medical advances, along with dramatic changes in doctor-patient relations and access to the state-of-the-art healthcare. Gutman, who chaired President Obama's Bioethics Commission, and Moreno, who served as senior advisor on that commission, show how breakthroughs in reproductive medicine, cancer research, infectious diseases, and drug developments provide Americans with new alternatives, yet often painful choices. Again, the name of the book is Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die, and we welcome co-author Jonathan Moreno to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
What brought you to this particular subject of wanting to look at bioethics when it comes to this transformation?
Well, Dr. Gutman and I have been in the field of bioethics in different ways for pretty much our whole careers, starting back in the late 1970s. Amy is, of course, the president of the University of Pennsylvania, but also a political philosopher, and she's been very interested in problems of insurance and access to health care. I'm a philosopher and historian, and I've been interested in the way that our new medical technologies confront us with new ethical issues. So because we had worked together on the President Obama's Bioethics Commission for 8 years, she was the chair, I was senior advisor. When we were done, it just seemed like a natural next project to work together to take a look back at our collectively, I hate to say, probably years together of work in bioethics, and how what's an academic field is also a subject of, you know, kitchen table conversation, how we make healthcare choices, whether somebody should be in an experiment or not, what their attitudes are about different health plans that political candidates are presenting, whether they should try one medication or another. It's both an academic field, but it's also a part of everyday life, the decisions that people make in their lives for themselves and their loved ones.
Given that both of you were part of President Obama's commission, what was it? What do you think you accomplished during that time, and give us a sense of where we are now?
Well, the commission was confronted with a wide range of issues that the president thought that it should consider. You know, for example, while we think that history is dead, actually history goes on. So about 9 years ago, it was discovered by a Wellesley College historian that the U.S. Public Health Service had engaged in some pretty gross experiments in Guatemala from 1946 to 1948 with regard to sexually transmissible diseases and penicillin. And these were experiments that were done with mental patients, with prisoners, in some cases with kids. That was new information that had to be, digested by the country. So the commission had that job. As you know, there's a lot of interest in new forms of genetic engineering and new ways of modifying human cells and experiments. And so we did a report on what's called synthetic biology. And toward the end, there was a two-volume report on brain science and what the ethical issues are in brain science that confront us. So, when presidential commissions don't have any legal authority, their job is to represent the public interest and reach some recommendations to guide public policy. And, people can make their own judgments. But all those reports are up on the web. They're all published. Nothing's secret. Everything is available to the public. And other people have to judge how we did.
When it comes to the work that you did in looking at, there's a chapter in the book called The High Price of Unfair Healthcare. Obviously, you're working as the Affordable Care Act was being worked on and worked out. Give us a sense of the duality of what you were doing as that debate was raging.
Well, of course, we were not specifically asked to participate in the drafting or the rolling out or the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, but as we were working on the commission. But of course, when we got to the book, it was time, we felt, to make some observations about how things were going. And by the way, we extended those observations in a New York Times op-ed in August, and hope people will take a look at that. Our concern is that we have a very expensive system that is not getting bang for its buck. And this is not new. People have been saying this for 30 years. Economists predicted in the 1980s that at the course we were on then, that we would be spending up to 20% of our gross domestic product on healthcare. Indeed, we're at 18%. And at current rates, unless we figure out a way to bend that curve, in 30 years, it'll be 50%. It's unsustainable. But we don't do well when you compare our outcomes, for example, in mortality, to other developed countries. We pay twice as much, and we get far less. So what I'm telling you is nothing new. People understand this, and they know there's a serious problem. What we don't want to happen is for the whole system to be, repealed, and then not knowing what will replace it. Because although the ACA, also known as Obamacare, has a long way to go, it has provided health care for tens of millions of people who did not have it before. So it's a start. When Medicare got off the ground in 1965, it was very controversial. I'm the son of a doctor, and I remember my father, when I was 13, 14 years old, explaining to me that a lot of doctors weren't happy about government insurance because they didn't want anybody getting in between them and their patients. But meanwhile, so many families were becoming impoverished because their parents and grandparents had serious illnesses, and they were paying out of pocket to take care of them. So then by the late 1960s, after a few years, Medicare got off the ground, doctors started realizing this is actually good for their practices. They had a stable source of income. And much the same, we think, may happen with the ACA. And what's the interesting thing here is that as the ACA has been attacked more and more by the administration, it's actually getting more popular. People are beginning to realize that it actually, it's a start. So in the book, at least, we ponder, why the ACA had this really had this negative profile, but when in fact, it's really following in the footsteps of Medicare, and there are problems, there's no question. But we're Americans, so we take it step by step, and if it's not right now, we go back and we fix it.
When it comes to bioethics, how do you feel it is addressed by the Affordable Health Care Act, and what is lost if it is replaced by something, let's say, lesser?
Well, the most important thing, of course, is that more people get access to insurance, so they are not reluctant to go to see a doctor to get bad news that means that they will have to lay up some money to be taken care of. In the mid-1990s, I had a close friend named Steve who had, for all his, he was about 15, 20 years older than me, and his whole life he had worked in the food business. He was a restaurant manager and a bartender. And I guess when he was in his early 50s, mid-50s, he started noticing that he had blood in his stool. And he only told me this a couple of years later. He didn't go see a doctor. It was a continuing problem, but he didn't want to face it because he didn't have any insurance. And the sad part is that he died of colon cancer that might, who knows, might have been treatable in the early stages. So, you know, that's the primary moral consideration, is that people need to feel that they can afford to get proper health care. Now, to the latter part of your question, here's what we do need to improve. What we need to improve is the way that doctors are paid, so that they can be paid for talking to patients. This is sometimes called cognitive services, and they're not really well compensated for primary care doctors. You know, I know when I go see my doctor, unless I have to see him in between my annual visits, he spends, you know, 8 or 10 minutes with me, and that's pretty much it. Now, fortunately, he's the kind of person who will keep other patients waiting if he needs to talk to me some more about something. But the onus is sort of ridiculously on the doctors to take that time. So that's something that really does need to be fixed. The other thing is there are junk insurance plans out there that are being sold to young people, especially who think that they can get away with a really high deductible, and they often don't cover them properly. Some states are allowing this. So we have some things to fix, but we're certainly in a better position now than we were before Obamacare.
Is there currently a presidential bioethics commission?
There is not, no.
Without such a commission, and I guess in the question comes of, then who ultimately decides, and how do decisions get made as to what is right and what is wrong when it comes to these medical treatments?
Well, the agencies, ultimately, the cabinet agencies of the executive branch have the responsibility to do what the president wants them to do with respect to any policy issues, and that is presumably what they're doing. The function of a presidential commission is to create a kind of a brighter light on the process of thinking ethically about issues in healthcare. So there is a clear advantage to that. We definitely have to submit to the political process. Just to take the example of where we're coming up to in 2020, different candidates have different views about where we should go with the ACA. And it's really now, you know, the burden is on the voter and the taxpayers to really put the politicians' feet to the fire and make them get very specific. I mean, we know that Senator Sanders is an advocate of Medicare for all. But we have a pretty good sense, I think, that Vice President Biden wants to build on Obamacare. But some of the other candidates haven't been so clear. So there are moral choices involved in how you cast your vote. It's not only about a presidential commission helping you understand and sort things out. The voters have to do that, too, with regard to the politicians.
As you mentioned, you are a philosopher and a historian. You specialize in bioethics, but you also specialize in national security and the intersections of bioethics and national security. Give us a sense of how that is playing out now and what we know and I guess more importantly, what we don't know.
Right. Yeah, I've been interested for a long time in the way, for example, that human experiments have been done to serve the needs of militaries, not only in the United States, but around the world. More recently, I've started to focus on the scary prospects of new biological weapons that are made possible by advances in biology and particularly in genetics. These are topics that people usually don't think about when they think about medical ethics, but medical ethics is really a key part of how militaries become successful. Just the simple things, like making sure that people are vaccinated for anthrax if there's a biological weapons threat, although that in itself was extremely controversial if you're of a certain age. You remember that in the 1990s in the first Gulf War. All the way over to thinking about new ways to for example, help young soldiers learn their skills faster if some new medication or device could help to do that. There really are deep questions that are raised by the role of medical research in the military context that are unique, because they often have to do with the survival of the country. And that's a little bit different from what we normally face in medical ethics and doctor-patient relationships.
What are your concerns? I mean, you address a lot in this book, and there's a lot to be concerned about. And I guess as our list of concerns adds up over the last couple of years, where should this rank, do you think?
I think it's pretty high because it medical ethics, it's not just about doctors. It's about the choices we make as individuals, as patients, as family members, and as voters. You think, for example, about the vaccine controversy. That controversy, I think, is partly tied up with what the polls tell us is a loss of confidence in institutions and experts. And I very much remember what things were like in the early 1970s, post-Vietnam and post-Watergate. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that. But
yes.
That was also an era of loss of faith in institutions. And what one difference is that when people thought about science in those days, for the most part, I'm talking now about the late 60s and early 70s, they were thinking about engineering. Right? They were thinking about the moonshot. They were thinking about physics. Today, when people think about science, they're increasingly thinking about the life sciences, biology, biochemistry, and the applications of the life sciences. It feels somehow more personal when people are pushing around body parts, cells, and the information contained in those cells and our DNA. It feels more personal than it does when we're talking about getting a tin can to the moon. So that has meant that science has become a more sensitive area, more politicized, really, and subject to more partisan concerns. You can just think about not only the vaccine controversy, but about climate change. We're going to have more and more concerns about that that also go to national security. As the oceans get warmer, there are going to be more and more problems that will drive large numbers of people into different parts of the world to escape those conditions. So the book itself is kind of focused on the more immediate medical and policy issues we face in bioethics, but there's a huge range of issues here.
Absolutely. The name of the book is Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, but Nobody Wants to Die: Bioethics and the Transformation of Healthcare in America. The book is published by Liberite. Jonathan Moreno, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.